This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. And we have reached summertime again, which means Jennifer and I are going to take a little break to recharge our critical thinking batteries, but also to bring you some best of episodes. And we love these because they're a way to give you a peek inside some of our favorite scientists, engineers, and experts episodes before you go listen to the whole thing. So this first best of episode is
The Best of Ice.
The Best of Ice! How cool! And I did mean that. That was a pun. So we are going to listen to How Are Glaciers Nature's Time Machine by Dr. Uli. How Do We Study Alien Ice by Dr. Will Grundy.
Ooh.
And one of Jeff's very favorites, What Is It Like to Fly by Pluto by Dr. Alan Stern.
Absolutely one of my favorites, and I could listen to all three of these episodes over and over again. P.S. I have. And all three of these connect very well to each other, so I definitely recommend listening to all three of them in a back-to-back sort of fashion. You will notice some trends that are very similar.
Oh, so have fun, listeners, and enjoy.
How Are Glaciers Nature's Time Machines?
How are glaciers nature's time machine? This sounds very cool. Who is our guest today, Jeff?
Our guest today is the absolutely awesome Dr. Uliana Horodisky, and she is, get this, a glaciologist, geologist, and a visiting professor of environmental science at Colorado College.
This is so exciting. Welcome to the show, Dr. Uli.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm actually at the college right now speaking to you guys.
That's awesome. So you can wave to Jeff then, right?
Yes. Yeah, across the way there.
So I have to ask, why glaciers, which I think are cool, and you're going to hear us say that a lot, but for a different reason.
It really started for me as a kid. So my parents really believed in experiential learning, not just like reading books, which I did a lot of as a kid, but like really putting us out into nature. So I was only 6 years old when I had my first experience in the mountains in Switzerland.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, wow.
Real mountains too.
Oh yeah, big ones.
I know a lot of people live in places that have little baby hills. They call them mountains.
I wasn't climbing yet at 6 years old, but they had this really cool railway that went up to about 10,000 feet. And then we got out, my two brothers and me and my parents, and it's snowing in July. Of course, we're running around, grabbing snowballs, throwing them at each other, just having a blast up there. And then in the distance, we heard like this big roar, like something collapsing. We're like, what is that? What is that? And we look behind and like all this ice had come down in an avalanche. I didn't know what that meant as a 6-year-old.
Wow.
What is that?
Okay.
Well, I was just like, wow, look at that. And I think that's kind of how I started getting interested in the natural world. There's just kind of this imprinting of like, wow, raw power of Mother Nature.
Yes.
I want to understand. I want to understand what are these things, you know? And then especially now in a time when everything's changing with the climate, you know, and things are warming up. We're losing the ice. We're losing the stories that they hold.
Yes.
So one thing that you just said right there at the end, we're losing the stories that they tell.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So when you think about it, how does a glacier start? It starts with snowflakes, right? And enough of them fall, they compress into ice. And enough of them, when we're talking about like miles thick ice in like the polar regions and other places, give it enough millions of years time to build.
That's hard to comprehend.
It is. It really is. Like when you think about like how tall that is. I was just in Central Park in New York City. There's actual evidence for past glaciers reaching all the way to New York City. And if you looked up, it would be like as high as some of those skyscrapers. Like it just blows my mind.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, imagine each one of those layers has a little story of what the weather was doing at the time. If you've ever seen tree rings,
they're
really thin sometimes. And when they're really thin, that means there wasn't enough water to grow. And when they're thicker, there was. So for a glacier, it's the same thing. When you have really thin layers, there wasn't that much snow falling. But then when you have thicker layers, then you had a lot more snow. And so you can actually look back in time through all those different layers to see if it was like a warm period or a cold period based on how much snow fell.
Wow. Okay. So how do you tell the layers apart? Because me, I'd look at ice and I go, oh, it's just ice, right? I mean, I can see the layers of rock and of course, like the Grand Canyon. Yeah. Does a glacier look like that too?
So it's a lot more subtle. And what scientists do is they drill these tubes and they kind of like if you think about putting a straw into something, imagine that straw is a tube and you go in and you get a sample. So scientists do that on a large scale to collect ice. And so they're kind of like 3 feet long sections at a time because otherwise they break apart.
Right. Okay.
And then they get cut in half and you can look with a special light and you can actually see, real subtle differences between the layers.
You mean cut in half lengthwise?
Correct. Yes.
So it's like cutting down the long way of the straw.
Yes.
Okay. Exactly. So you can see the whole inside of that core.
Yeah. Wow. And sometimes there's not just ice there, but sometimes you'll see like random thick layers of dark stuff. You're like, what is that? It could be volcanic ash. So, there's a really like famous ice core from Antarctica. It's one of the longest ice cores in the world. Like it took like 5 years to pull out all the sections.
Oh my gosh.
But they did it. And so you can look back at time, hundreds of thousands of years as a result. And they noticed some of these thicker layers and like, what is this stuff? And then they were actually able to look back in time at when volcanoes erupted in Antarctica and match it with chemistry to those volcanoes, which is pretty wild.
Why do we study alien ice?
Why do we study alien ice? Oh, now I understand why you're so excited about this episode. Who is our guest?
I knew you'd figure it out right away. Our guest is the very cool Dr. Will Grundy, planetary scientist at Lowell Observatory.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Will.
Hello, all. It's great to be with you.
We are thrilled to have you with us, and you get to study space and all of the different things in it. So can you tell us a little bit specifically what you study?
So I'm mostly interested in the outer objects in our solar system, the places where it's far away from the sun and super duper cold, places like Pluto and the icy satellites of the giant planets.
Wow.
Okay. So you just mentioned the outer solar system. I know a lot of our listeners are learning that there is that third zone out there now called the Kuiper Belt. One question I've always wondered, how many Kuiper Belt objects are there? And obviously that's going to be an estimate. I don't think you've counted them, Dr. Will. And how many of them are rock versus how many of them are ice?
So we've only discovered a few thousand.
Oh, okay.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. There's tons more out there. It's been estimated that the surface area of objects that are maybe around 100 miles or bigger in size in the Kuiper Belt exceeds the surface area of all of the solid bodies in the rest of the solar system. So, you know, Earth, Venus, Mars, all the icy satellites adds up to less surface area than what's out in the Kuiper Belt. So this is not a small region. If you like alien exotic geology, there's a lot of it out there.
Holy cow. Can you give us an estimate? Because maybe some people don't know. How far is the Kuiper Belt from us?
So traditionally, the Kuiper Belt is the region beyond Neptune. And sometimes people call them trans-Neptunian objects instead of Kuiper Belt objects.
Right.
I might use those terms interchangeably on you. So the measuring stick for the solar system is the Earth-Sun separation, and that's called an astronomical unit. That's right. 1 AU, 93 million miles. And Neptune is at 30 AU, so 30 times as far from the sun as Earth is. And the Kuiper Belt continues on out to maybe around 50 or so, with a straggling tail that extends much, much even further than that. So the solar system's a big place. And the region with the giant planets, Jupiter's at about 5 AU out to Neptune at 30. So that's kind of the middle zone from my point of view. Wow. And then the Kuiper Belt extends that far again.
Okay. That's a lot. That's huge.
And that is very far away, like I mentioned in the intro. Can you tell us what types of telescopes or instruments you're using to study that far away?
Sure. Anything you can get your hands on, you use, right? So if you can get time on the Hubble Space Telescope, you go. If you can get time on James Webb Space Telescope, you go for it. You can also use ground-based telescopes. And because it's in our solar system, you can send spacecraft out there. And so the New Horizons spacecraft that sent back those fabulous pictures of Pluto, I guess 6-7 years ago now, you know, it took it a decade to get out to the outer solar system.
Right.
It's a long trip, but you can do that in our solar system.
Sure. I want to follow up with one. You did mention ground-based telescopes. I do amateur astronomy with an 8-inch telescope.
Yeah.
I know I'm not seeing a Kuiper Belt object in my backyard.
Well, you might be able to. I mean, Pluto was discovered with like a, what was it, a 12-inch telescope? 13-inch?
Wow.
Okay, so I was going to say, how big does a telescope on the ground need to be to start seeing one? And then how big are the ones that you're using to actually study?
Yeah. Bigger is better, of course, because the photons, the particles of light that you're looking at, they have to originate at the sun. They go out to the Kuiper Belt, which is a long distance.
Yes.
Right.
And then they reflect off the surface of some small body out there. And then they have to come all the way back in to where we can see them.
Wow.
And so it's like trying to catch a handful of raindrops when it's barely raining at all. You know, the bigger the bucket you got, the more raindrops you're going to catch.
Okay.
So the biggest telescopes in the world are the best ones for this purpose. And these are things like the 10-meter Keck telescopes out on Hawaii. And there's a very large European telescopes down in Chile and so on.
Okay.
So I've been reading a little bit about telescopes. Can you explain to our listeners the difference between what you see on, from a ground-based telescope versus the Hubble? Like, talk about the atmosphere and how that affects what you see.
Yeah. So there's the atmosphere is interfering with what you're seeing in two distinct ways. One is that it ripples and shimmers and so on. And so it just distorts the image that you see. And astronomers call that seeing and moan and groan about it a lot. But the other is that the atmosphere absorbs certain wavelengths of light. And especially there are very diagnostic wavelengths of light out in the infrared and in the ultraviolet and so on that you just can't see through the atmosphere at all. It's totally opaque. So it's, you know, it's like if you had your telescope at the bottom of a swimming pool and you were trying to look up through the ripples on the surface of the swimming pool and, you know, the water is absorbing light and so on. So that's what you win by getting up to low Earth orbit or L2, where James Webb Space Telescope is going to be located.
So we're going to get a really good view, hopefully, of some amazing far out stuff in space from the James Webb.
Exactly.
What is it like to fly by Pluto?
What is it like to fly by Pluto? This is going to be amazing. Who's our guest, Jeff?
Our guest today, Jennifer, is the one and only Dr. Alan Stern. He is the principal investigator from the New Horizons mission to Pluto and beyond. But that's what he's most well known for. But Dr. Stern is such a busy guy. He is also a scientist, an astronaut, payload specialist, a dad, a pilot, an author, and a speaker. So let's get to talking to him.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Stern.
Thanks, Jeff and Jennifer. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are thrilled to have you. I guess I want to just jump in. And can you tell everybody the amazing thing that New Horizons has done?
Sure. New Horizons is a NASA spacecraft. It's a robotic spacecraft. No one's aboard it. It launched in 2006 to take care of some unfinished business, namely something that the Voyager missions were not able to do, to make the first exploration of the Pluto system, Pluto and its system of moons, way far away, the farthest exploration in history, over 3 billion miles from Earth, and then to go on to explore objects in the Kuiper Belt, the third zone of our solar system, which we're doing now.
That's phenomenal.
So, Dr. Stern, obviously I'm a big fan, and I've been studying your work, and you talk about that third zone of the solar system a lot, and I don't think too many kids and students are learning the solar system in three zones. Could you explain that a little bit more?
I'd be happy to. Sure. And this is all about some pretty new stuff, discoveries made in the not too distant past. We used to think of the solar system, and I think kids see it in their textbooks when they learn a little bit of the geography of the solar system with the names of the planets. Right. The four inner planets are somewhat similar, even though they have diverse personalities, but they're so-called rocky planets that orbit close to the sun.
Right.
That's Mercury,
right.
Venus, Earth, and Mars, in that order going outward. And then beyond those four are the four gas giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, in that order.
Right.
But beyond that, beyond the inner zone of the rocky planets and the what is now the middle zone of the giant planets,
okay,
is the outer zone called the Kuiper Belt, which is teeming with small planets like Pluto. It's the third zone of our solar system. And although Pluto was discovered in 1930,
right,
its context as one of many of these small planets and the other objects that orbit out there wasn't known until the 90s and 2000s.
Wow. That is a long time in between.
That is. And so I guess, how do you design something that's going to fly that far and then send photos back to us? Because I'm assuming that's what it's doing, right?
Well, you know, like a lot of space projects, it actually is rocket science. It actually is. And the team that put New Horizons together, that's the spacecraft, the launch vehicle, the nuclear power supply, all of the scientific sensors, that team involved 2,500 men and women, and most of them engineers, very few of them scientists by comparison, a lot of technicians who did the actual construction, and of course our mission operations team. So you have a lot of, you have to hire really talented people that know electrical engineering, that know mechanical engineering,
right,
many other engineering fields. And then they had to be very careful because unlike most of the first-time exploration missions that NASA has flown, we couldn't afford to send two. So there was no backup to New Horizons.
Oh,
from the moment we launched it, it was on its own, and it was going to really have to work. And even though we were the fastest spacecraft ever launched, set speed records and all that,
wow,
went to the moon,
that's cool,
in just 9 hours after we launched.
Oh my gosh.
In Apollo missions
fast.
For 3 days, we were 0.3 days. Even at that high speed, New Horizons took 9.5 years to cross the entire solar system out to Pluto. And the Voyagers, you know, they took 12 years just to go to Neptune. So we were going quite a bit faster. That spacecraft had to be reliable over that whole period of time. And then it had to do its most strenuous things at the end of the line. You know, so there was a lot of thought, obviously, put into the design and to the testing of it before it was on its own, flying away from the Earth.
Wow.
Very cool.
So I definitely have chills after listening to all three of those episodes. And what did I tell you? There are definitely links between studying ice here on Earth and studying alien ice at worlds all the way as far away as the Kuiper Belt and Pluto.
Oh, yes, it was such an amazing episode. So if you want to hear all of them, make sure that you go to our website, solveitforkids.com, or you can check us out on iTunes or Spotify or anywhere that you listen to podcasts. And if you liked the episodes, don't forget to let us know on our social media. We are at KidSolve at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
And until the next episode of Solve It for Kids, Jen and Jeff will still be here on Earth. We'll hear you next time on
Solve It for Kids.